Neonatal jaundice can be a significant cause of worry, especially for first-time parents. Fortunately, most cases of jaundice will resolve on their own and have no long-term adverse effects. There are, however, some causes of jaundice that can have serious implications for newborns, resulting in seizures and even brain damage. In today's podcast, we will be exploring the topic of neonatal jaundice. We will cover which causes of jaundice are benign and which are more serious. Welcome to Probable Pods for Docs. My name is Sophia, and in today's podcast, we will be covering the topic of neonatal jaundice. For visual aids on today's topic, head over to our website at probable.com for high-yield revision notes and a question bank. Today, we are very fortunate to again be joined by Dom, who's a paediatric registrar, and he's going to help us break down and understand this topic. Dom, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Sophia. Nice to be back with Pods for Docs. So I am Dom. I'm a paediatric registrar in London, and I'm excited to be here to talk to you about jaundice, which is a really common but really important topic in neonatology. And it can range from the barely perceptible and pretty irrelevant right through to being a sign of really serious underlying pathology.
So let's start with the basics. What is jaundice? So jaundice describes a clinical sign that you can observe in people when you're literally just looking at them. And it's where their skin and even the sclera in their eyes can turn a yellow color. Think of The Simpsons when you think of yellow skin. So what causes jaundice? So we need to go back to basic physiology of a red blood cell. And I'm going to try and keep this as brief as possible. So we know that in adults, red blood cells have a finite lifespan, which is typically about 120 days. Now, in neonates and newborns, red blood cells actually have a shorter lifespan of about 60 to 90 days. When red blood cells reach the end of their life, they have to be broken down and recycled. Now, the iron on the red blood cell is recycled and put back into your system. Another important byproduct of red blood cell breakdown is the hemoglobin. This is broken down into a product called heme, which is then subsequently broken down into a product called bilirubin. Bilirubin is initially unconjugated, so not attached to anything, is the simple way that I think of that. Now, when it's cycled through the body, it has to go through the liver. And once it's gone through the liver, it becomes conjugated, so bound to something. And the chemical that it gets bound to is something called glucuronic acid. And essentially, all this does is it makes the bilirubin more water soluble so that it's easier to excrete. So when you think about your urine, that's normally a yellow color, and your stool is normally a brown color. This color is actually part and parcel from the conjugated bilirubin that your body is trying to excrete and process. Now, jaundice, which is the yellowing of skin or the eyes, is essentially the accumulation of bilirubin in the body. And this can be caused by both benign and pathological conditions in the neonate. And this is what we're going to go over today. Dom, can you kick us off by telling us about physiological jaundice in the neonate and why it is so common?
Yeah, a very nice summary of the pathophysiology of jaundice there. So physiological jaundice is just that. It's a physiological part of newborn babies. There are two real reasons why neonates are much more susceptible to jaundice and why they get jaundiced. The first one is that they've got all of the fetal hemoglobin in them that was floating around while they were a fetus that helped them oxygenate from mum's blood. So for that, they're a little bit more polycythemic. They've got more red blood cells, and they've got all of this fetal blood that when they're born, they don't really need anymore. So they start to break it all down. And just like you said, that breakdown of red blood cells generates this bilirubin. The other thing that makes them more susceptible is the fact that their liver is still a little bit immature. So it can't process the bilirubin as quickly as it might otherwise be able to. So effectively, the whole system just gets backed up. It leads to a buildup of this unconjugated, unprocessed bilirubin in the blood. And that's what slowly turns the babies yellow. This is normal. And it's important to note this happens in pretty much all babies to varying degrees. And that's why we call it physiological jaundice.
Okay, brilliant. So while we're on the topic of something that's incredibly benign and quite common, I want to come on to the common phenomenon that is breast milk jaundice. And I believe this typically comes on after 24 hours post-birth and is, again, you know, not something necessarily to be that worried about in an infant. Can you tell us, Dom, why breastfed infants are more prone to developing jaundice and how long a parent could expect that to last?
So I think the short answer to your question of why breast milk babies get more jaundice is that no one really knows, but it's a very widely observed phenomenon that babies that are exclusively breastfed are more likely to have higher jaundice levels than those that aren't. But again, it's all part of that physiological spectrum. Breastfeeding is a normal part of being a baby. So it generally doesn't cause any lasting effects. It doesn't really cause anything that needs treatment. And mostly can just manage this with reassurance. But it is important to keep an eye on those jaundice levels, particularly in babies that are breastfed. The other thing that might make breastfed babies more susceptible is they tend to have smaller fluid volumes when they're little. Giving a baby a bottle of formula is always going to have more volume than breastfeeding in the first few days of life. And obviously, if you are more dehydrated, your blood is going to be more concentrated. And also the reduced urine output means that excretion is a little bit less. So those bilirubin levels tend to rise a little bit quicker in babies that are exclusively breastfed.
Now we've covered those, let's move on to the pathological causes that we need to be aware of. We can break this down by splitting the causes of neonatal jaundice into two groups. So we can think of it as early jaundice or prolonged jaundice. Don, can you define these two categories and how they differ?
So early jaundice is really becoming jaundice to perceptible levels in the first few days of life. We get particularly worried if it's within the first 24 hours after birth. That usually implies there's something a little bit pathological going on. After that, we expect most bilirubin levels to start to fall, usually around the 1 week to 10 day mark. If the jaundice persists, and it can persist up to a couple of weeks in full-term babies, or we'd expect it to be a little bit longer in preterms, up to 3 weeks in preterms, then we start to call it prolonged jaundice. And that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Let's start with the first category that you described to us. So this is the early and the frequently pathological causes of jaundice. One example of this is hemolytic disease of the newborn. What is that, Dom?
This is a classic. So there are two types of important hemolytic disease in newborns to be aware of. The first one is the ABO blood group incompatibility, and the second is the rhesus incompatibility. Effectively, these are the same process going on, but they present very differently. So the general process is when babies have a different blood group to mum, and mum's antibodies recognize baby's blood as something abnormal. So if you think about a mum who has O blood group O and a baby that's got blood group A, all of baby's red blood cells have a little bit of extra antigen stuck on them. Now, mum's body can recognize those as abnormal and she builds up an immune response to them. In the womb, this isn't really a problem, but when baby is born, some of those antibodies can cross over into baby and suddenly you've got antibodies in the baby that's breaking down its own red blood cells. So as we've already mentioned that jaundice comes from breakdown of red blood cells, this means that you build up your jaundice levels even quicker. And you can, in extreme circumstances, become quite anemic with this as well. Rhesus incompatibility is a really severe form of this, and it affects the rhesus group, so that positive or negative on blood groups. This doesn't affect babies in the first pregnancy. Mums need to go through a process called sensitization, where in the first pregnancy, they recognize this positive rhesus group as abnormal. And in the second pregnancy, they build up quite a ferocious reaction to it. And this can lead to really profound pathology, even cause intrauterine death. So both of these can lead to jaundice, but the rhesus group is much more severe. Luckily, in the UK, we now give first-time mums who are rhesus negative an injection of anti-rhesus D antigen in their first pregnancy. This mops up any of that antigen that's kicking around and stops mums going through that sensitization process, meaning that their future babies won't be affected by this.
Okay, Dom, so thanks for taking us through the pathophysiology underlying why these babies get jaundice. Could you tell us how you'd manage this scenario?
Rhesus disease is pretty severe, and usually these babies are picked up in utero if they've got all of the nasty things going on. But ABO incompatibility is really common. And we normally just pick these babies up because they are jaundiced like any other baby. And they can often overlap with the physiological jaundiced babies. The one thing that separates them is the direct Coombs test, or the DAT test. So that is a way to check if there are also antibodies against baby's own red blood cells. If that test is positive and mum and baby have blood groups that are compatible with hemolytic disease, then we call it hemolytic disease and treat it accordingly. In the first instance, it's pretty much the same as any other jaundice. So we talk about feeding support, phototherapy, and potentially the other things that we'll come onto later in the podcast. And then long term, you need to make sure that babies don't become too anemic by all of their blood being broken down. So we tend to give them a course of a few months of folic acid and just monitor their full blood counts and hemoglobin levels over the next couple of weeks to make sure they don't drop too far.
We will go into detail a bit later on in the podcast about the ways we can manage jaundice, but knowing the specifics to that condition is really useful. Another early and important cause of jaundice to be able to recognize is neonatal infection. Dom, how would we recognize this in a neonate? What would be our clues?
So a baby that becomes very jaundiced very early, we're always thinking, is this caused by an infection? And again, no one really knows the underlying cause of why babies with infections are more prone to jaundice. It's probably something to do with increased red cell breakdown and the liver being involved in that immune response. In any baby that becomes jaundiced in that first 24 hours of life, you need to do a really good examination, look at the baby's observations and check if they look well. If there's anything that makes you uncomfortable, for example, if they've got any signs of respiratory distress, if they're tachycardic or they're just a bit lethargic, they may well be brewing an infection and need to be treated for suspected sepsis with IV antibiotics.
There are a couple of other conditions that can also result in early onset of jaundice. And there are two genetic conditions that I would like to touch on, one of which is G6PD deficiency, and the other being hereditary spherocytosis, which is a bit of a mouthful. Dom, can you explain to us briefly what G6PD is and how that causes jaundice?
G6PD is an enzyme that most people have, and its role is basically to protect red blood cells from oxidative stresses. Things that put oxidative stress on the body tend to lead to increased turnover of red blood cells and increased breakdown, making you more susceptible to jaundice. Luckily, this enzyme is pretty good at preventing that. But in certain populations, this enzyme is quite deficient, meaning red blood cells are very susceptible to anything that causes oxidative stress, which then leads to hemolytic anemia. The classic one for medical students is fava beans, where you eat fava beans and suddenly your hemoglobin drops through the floor. So that's the classic one. The other thing you mentioned is hereditary spherocytosis. So this is another one where people's red blood cells are just that little bit more fragile and more at risk of being broken down. So again, increased red blood cell breakdown, increased jaundice. Both of those things can lead to jaundice in the newborn period. And again, they're fairly simple to screen for. G6PD deficiency can be checked on just looking at levels of G6PD in the blood. And spherocytosis can be picked up by having a look at a blood film.
Brilliant. Okay. So that's a whistle-stop tour of the early causes of jaundice. And those are the main ones to be aware of. We're going to move on now to prolonged jaundice. Prolonged jaundice is defined as jaundice that is present up to 2 weeks after delivery in a term baby, or up to 3 weeks in a preterm baby, as Dom said earlier. The key thing to identify in these infants is whether the jaundice is caused by excessive conjugated bilirubin or excessive unconjugated bilirubin. Those are both quite a bit of a mouthful, but Dom, can you explain to us what the difference between these are and why it is relevant to prolonged jaundice?
Of course, this is a really important distinction for these babies. So the first thing to say is it's not uncommon for physiological jaundice babies or breast milk jaundice babies to remain jaundiced for quite a long time, even up to 2 or 3 weeks. And this is fine. What you need to make sure, exactly as you say, is that it's not caused by a buildup of conjugated bilirubin. That is bilirubin that's been processed by the liver, but then instead of being excreted either in the wee or the poo, has got stuck in the body and is slowly building up. And this is a problem. In the first few days of life, when we check a jaundice level, we really look at the total bilirubin. We lump conjugated and unconjugated in together. But as babies get older, we need to make sure if that conjugated bilirubin is building up. Because if it is, it may well be the first signs of a really nasty condition called biliary atresia. Biliary atresia is where there is destruction or lack of bile ducts, usually outside of the liver. That means that the bile has got nowhere to drain to. It just backs up into the liver, and all of that conjugated bilirubin that should normally be excreted slowly gets reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. Because the bilirubin isn't being excreted in the bile, you get the classic chalky, pale white stools. So if you ever see a newborn baby with white stools, that's a really bad sign. And then because this bilirubin slowly builds back up in the bloodstream, the only way out is through the urine. So you classically get dark brown urine as well. So that combination of pale stools and dark urine should make any pediatrician worried. The reason biliary atresia is so important is it can lead to quite rapid destruction of the liver. And unless you pick it up quickly and act on it quickly, it can lead to liver failure and the need for liver transplants. In fact, biliary atresia is the biggest cause of needing a liver transplant as a child worldwide. Luckily, if you pick it up early, and it really has to be within the first 6 weeks of life, then something can be done about it. And that thing is called a Kasai procedure, where you reconnect the liver and the biliary tree up to the bowel and enable that drainage of bile.
One of the main reasons recognizing jaundice, investigating and managing it is so important is due to the possible effect of excessive bilirubin in the neonate, especially on the brain. So Dom's already talked about how excessive bilirubin can damage the liver, but there's also a condition called bilirubin encephalopathy or Kernicterus, which is the effect of excessive bilirubin buildup within the brain. Don, can you tell us why this is dangerous and what effect it can have on the young brain?
Kernicterus is really nasty. Because unconjugated bilirubin is able to cross the blood-brain barrier, it can get into the brain and is actually neurotoxic, particularly at high concentrations. So when you get to high levels of jaundice, and they have to be really quite high, the unconjugated bilirubin deposits itself in the brain and causes what is effectively irreversible brain damage. This can lead to a huge host of issues. Initially, your baby might start to look quite lethargic. They might just have poor feeding, look a little bit sleepy. And soon this can progress to irritability, seizures, and really quite severe neurodisability. Long-term, children can have cerebral palsy, learning difficulties, and even sensory neural deafness as well as a cause of this. Luckily, jaundice is incredibly treatable, so this shouldn't really happen, but it's so important to be vigilant to make sure that you get a handle on rising bilirubin levels quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. We understand the importance of recognizing jaundice now. Let's talk about the general investigations that one would do to an infant that is presenting with jaundice. Dom, can you take us through a systematic approach that you take when you come across neonates that have jaundice?
The first thing to do is recognize a baby that might be becoming jaundiced. Exactly as you said, they start to have that Simpson-esque appearance and get very yellow. It usually starts in the face and then slowly works its way down. So if you ever see a jaundiced baby, you'll notice that their nose might be bright yellow, but their toes will be very pink. That said, we are classically terrible at working out jaundice severity on skin color alone. They've done some studies that show that it is almost impossible for healthcare professionals to work out whether a baby is severely jaundiced or mildly jaundiced just by looking at them. So you need to get a proper level. There are a couple of ways you can do this. The first is the good old-fashioned blood test. So just take a blood sample and get your total bilirubin level. But we also have things called transcutaneous bilirubin meters, which are effectively a little thing that you press to the baby's skin, and it gives you a rough reading of how jaundiced they are. Once you've got a numerical measure of exactly this baby's bilirubin concentration, you can plot it on some lovely graphs that are available on nice websites that give you an indication of how worried you should be about this baby's jaundice. And there are two things you need to look at. First of all is the absolute level. How jaundiced are they? But also, how quickly are they becoming jaundiced? if your bilirubin level is going up really fast, it implies that something like those hemolytic processes are going on and you need to get on top of it quickly. With the bilirubin graphs, and I'd encourage everyone, if you haven't seen, just to go and have a look at them, you'll notice that if the more preterm you are, the lower the thresholds for treatment are. And that's because the preterm brain is much more susceptible to this damage because of unconjugated bilirubin. So the more preterm you are, the quicker you might need to start treatment. The other blood tests that are really important to think about, as well as your bilirubin level, would be a full blood count. So just make sure that the baby's not got a hemolytic process going on and not dropping their hemoglobin. And if a baby is significantly jaundiced, you probably want to think about some other things. So you want to think about doing a blood group to see if there is a setup for hemolytic disease of the newborn. And with that is your direct antiglobulin test or your direct Coombs test to see if there is hemolysis. The next thing you want to think about is whether this baby's got signs of infection. Like we mentioned earlier, if they're looking a little bit poorly, if they're a bit lethargic, you might want to screen them for a possible infection, and that would need a CRP as well as blood cultures and starting them on broad spectrum antibiotics. And finally, if they've got ongoing jaundice that looks out of keeping with a standard physiological picture, you might want to think about G6PD testing or a blood film as well.
Obviously, how we go about managing neonatal jaundice largely depends on the actual cause. So if possible, treating the cause, such as an infection, for example, will actually help in resolving the jaundice. However, there are steps that can be taken to help the little ones through the process of getting rid of all this excess bilirubin and preventing any horrible complications like connectorus from occurring. Dom, can you cover the management strategies that you use to treat these infants for jaundice?
Probably the most important management strategy, and one that we use every day, is good old-fashioned reassurance and feeding support. It's so important, particularly for anxious parents, to let them know that jaundice is a completely normal process. And improving breastfeeding, getting feeding in early, is going to go a long way to bringing bilirubin levels down quickly, as well as giving parents a little bit of peace of mind. However, if the jaundice levels are high enough to go across what we call the phototherapy threshold on those jaundice graphs that we talked about, then unsurprisingly, babies need to be started on something called phototherapy. So that is pretty much as basic as shining bluey green lights onto the baby's skin. How it works is far more complicated. The specific light waves that you use do a thing called photooxidize and photoisomerize the bilirubin. Now, in very simple terms, this just makes it much more dissolvable. It makes it much, much easier for babies to excrete it. But let's not go too much into the science of how that works. What is important is how long babies are in contact with the light spore. The light only penetrates a couple of millimeters into the skin, and it takes a long time for the light to have a decent effect. So if you start a baby on phototherapy, you need to make sure that they're under the lights for as long as possible. There are a couple of ways of doing this. You have lights that shine directly down onto babies, or you've got things called billy blankets, which effectively strap onto the back of babies. And then they can be used for cuddles and for breastfeeding without taking the baby off the phototherapy at all. It's always fun to wander onto a neonatal unit and you just see all of these babies glowing blue, and they've got little eye protectors on them as well. So it looks like they're chilling on sun lounges with sunglasses. The next step of treatment, which sadly is a lot less cute if phototherapy doesn't work, is something called an exchange transfusion. This is for those babies that are severely jaundiced and you're really getting worried about connectorus. And again, there is an exchange transfusion threshold line on those nice jaundice charts as well. Exchange transfusion is as crude as taking all of the baby's blood out and replacing it with non-jaundiced blood. Obviously, you can't do that in one go, so you do that very gradually by taking a little bit out at a time with a slow blood transfusion running. And in fact, you aim to transfuse double the baby's circulating volume with fresh non-jaundiced blood. It's a pretty significant undertaking. It takes a few hours and it's very risky. If you get a mismatch in how much blood you're taking out compared to how much blood you're putting in, you can lead to profound anemia and hypovolemia. Or on the other side, you can lead to severe polycythemia. So it needs to be done really cautiously. The final trick we have up our sleeves for those babies that are severely jaundiced is good old intravenous immunoglobulin. So This only works in those babies that have got ongoing hemolysis. So they've got autoantibodies attacking their red blood cells. And if you give them anti-human immunoglobulin, it mops up all of those antibodies and stops that hemolytic process in its tracks. Again, quite a significant undertaking, but a really good way to prevent connectorous in those babies that are high risk.
I think we're reaching the end of the podcast. There's quite a lot of information and there's quite a lot going on in this topic. We actually found it quite difficult to condense it down into a podcast. But Don, could you give us a couple of take-home messages of what you would want people to remember about neonatal jaundice?
Of course. So jaundice is normal and it's common. And that is so important, particularly for new parents. But for doctors, it's so important to keep an eye on those jaundice levels early. And if it goes across those thresholds, to treat it early as well, to avoid that nasty condition called connectorous. In those babies that are treated for jaundice, always have a think about what else could be going on. Is this because of hemolysis? Is this because of infection? Or is there something weird going on that's meaning babies are more susceptible than they might otherwise be? And my last important point is if you've got prolonged jaundice, do a conjugated bilirubin level, because catching biliary atresia early is so important.
So I think that's it for today. Thank you so much, Don, for joining us and guiding us through what is quite a monster topic. We want to thank you all for listening, and we hope today's discussion has been helpful. To test your application of today's knowledge, head over to our website at pabble.com for an extensive question bank and revision note resource. We'll see you next time.